I mean, what a result, my friend. Blown away.
Well, it was nice to be out there, wasn't it, to release the first episode and to see the reaction.
I mean, we've been working on this thing for 9 months, or arguably longer, and the angst and the pain and the stress that it's caused us over that time to finally let it breathe and put it out into the world is a huge relief.
For you, is a bit like live theatre, film, TV, that kind of buzz?
It's exactly that. It gives you a really warm feeling inside if the reviews are favourable, and don't let any actor tell you different. Every actor reads the reviews. Of course they do. And I read the reviews here, and I was very heartened by what I read. There's a lot to learn, but I'm very, very happy with what I've read, and by the numbers that are listening. That's great news for the salmon.
Speaking of the warm feeling, was it a bit like when you did your fishing TV show?
A tiny bit like that. I think arguably this podcast has a bigger audience than that TV show had. I'll leave it up to the listeners to decide why that was. And speaking of angling TV shows, who have we got on this week's podcast, Dara?
Well, we've two guests. The first is a person who I grew up, when I was younger, mad into fishing, seeing him on TV or reading his books. The revered, the inestimable John Bailey. It was an absolute pleasure and an honour to have him on and to talk to him about fishing, salmon, just to get some insights, to hear from the man. And of course, the reason why we had him on was he was the wizard in the background. Huge part of the success of the TV show Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing. And the other guest is Jim.
Well, I'm thrilled to announce, ladies and gentlemen, that we have none other than comedic giant, national treasure, Bob Mortimer.
No, we couldn't afford him.
Oh, you're right. We have, ladies and gents, we have the other guy. We have Paul Whithouse. He's the guy that does the fishing, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's quite a good angler.
He's a great angler. Well cast. Bob's the funny one. Paul Whithouse and John Bailey joining us today. And Dara, just share with the audience a little bit about what they can expect from today's episode.
They talk about the success of the TV show, and Paul has some very strong opinions. You know, you can really hear how much the salmon means to him, how much fishing means to him, but he's some very strong opinions when it comes to what needs to be done to help save the Atlantic.
He does, though. Both him and John, arguably some would say radical, and I'm inclined to agree with a lot of what they say.
Well, it's part of the reason why we have this podcast. We're going to have different opinions. People who are very vested, believe passionately in the sport, and it's not just one opinion or one size fits all here. So I do think it's will probably stir up a lot of controversy in terms of what Paul and John have to say, but there's a sizable community of people who have similar opinions. So it's well worth hearing from two giants of angling and what they have to say.
Great. So without further ado, in the words of that world-famous DJ, let's hear from our majestic guests, great mate.
I know this sounds corny, but the last 7 years or so on Gone Fishing has really meant a lot, because I think it's really brought fishing back into the public arena. And I just love the genuineness of it. I love the fact we don't go to commercials. We don't take shortcuts. It's all very, very genuine. And I think how fishing actually should be portrayed. And I think it's what a fishing life's about. So now I'm incredibly ancient. It's been a real sort of tonic for me to be involved with something that I think is really good for the sport, really good for conservation, and really good about how the public sees fishing and sees how valuable it is.
The things that really struck me, and I like you, I read a lot of John's books when he was young, and he had a nice mane of golden hair, didn't he?
Yeah.
Hey?
He did.
Yeah. He claims he played for Stockport County, but there's no record of it. And why would you want to have a record of playing for Stockport County? But the thing that that was really significant for me, for John, was the roach that he used to catch. Huge roach, and also the Marcia, because, I mean, my introduction to... I've never fished for Marcia, and I'm probably too old to do it now, but what I loved about it was, you know, you could go on that journey without having to endure the heat and the flies and so on, you know. But that extraordinary creature out there in that extraordinary environment. And I remember you saying how welcome you were and how friendly everyone was, and the indigenous population and the guides were fantastic. And you painted this extraordinary picture of this world, you know, that was so different to the Waveney and the Wensum. Yeah. So I love that those two elements, you know, that sort of bucolic, I believe is the word, English sort of rolling countryside, and then the foothills of the Himalayas. Incredible that you were occupied both those worlds. And so I found that very fascinating about your angling life.
You said you had been approached, or you had had ideas before about putting out an angling show, but actually you always held back, or you always said no to whatever commissioner, because you didn't think an angling show for the sake of, you know, just for the sake of angling and having you from the world of comedy, it felt a bit contrived. But as soon as you had that story, you know, both of you convalescing from heart issues, that was the thing that spurred you to actually commit.
It was a glorious opportunism on my part, Jim. You know, I thought, well, one of us might drop dead on the riverbank. There's your jeopardy. You know, I'm not good enough an angler to say this is a, you know, masterclass in this particular, you know, branch of angling. So I could never do a program where I was presenting that. I'd have to have either an expert on, which has been done quite a bit, you know, or I find someone who's so inept and so hopeless that I actually look good next to him.
Yeah.
And
that's what I did with Robson.
I know, exactly. I've seen it, Jim. Don't worry. I've seen his fake casting. Christ. But yeah, it had a legitimacy then that I felt perhaps it wouldn't have if it was just an angling program hosted by me. You know, it means more, obviously.
But tell us about your experience with Atlantic salmon. I mean, obviously, both of you have been fishing for that fish for as long as you've been fishing, I'm guessing, and therefore have had more than a front, you know, a stall's view, if you like, of its demise, sadly, certainly from an angler's point of view. Tell us a bit about that.
I was a course fisher, really, Jim, in my early days. Then I'd always trout fished because my dad trout fished. So we do course fishing and a bit of trout fishing back in Wales, where he came from, and Ireland as well, because he had family in Ireland. But we never really graduated to salmon fishing. I think he always felt it was sort of not for him, weirdly. Until later in life, and he's, you know, he started to earn a bit of money later on in life, and I started to do reasonably well, and via kind of focus and sea trout fishing, we then sort of, you know, sea trout and salmon often, you know, inhabit the same world, don't they? So started to get into a bit of salmon fishing on the Tybee. And in fact, I caught my first salmon on the Tybee. And that was, you know, if you hit it right, there were good runs of salmon on the Towie, the Tybee, the Coffee, the Dovey, and sea trout in all those rivers as well. So gradually, you know, the salmon started to enter my world a lot more. And a couple of mates of mine from our course fishing background as kids, as I say, came with me, and we started to go up to Scotland and fish the odd not so brilliant beats on the Dee. But, you know, the salmon was reasonably prolific then, although even then, and I'm talking sort of late 80s, everyone was saying, oh, you should have been here, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And if you want to take it right back 100 years ago, you know, I opened the Tay the other day, and I think you've done it before now, Jim, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. Great fun. Yeah.
And, you know, as we all know, Georgie Girl caught the record salmon from UK waters. I did say, looking around at some of the crowd, some of you were there by the looks of it.
Yeah. I bet a lot of stony faces, I'd imagine, and spinning rods.
I said that to him. I went, I said, good morning. Seems weird saying good morning. I do my best work at night like a vampire or a murderer. But good morning, ladies, gentlemen, and others. And by others, I mean gillies.
Tough crowd, huh?
Tough crowd, yeah. I said, I'm not scared of you lot. I'm not. I was.
Yeah.
No, but you know, look at those fish from 100 years ago, those massive fish that seem to be caught in all our rivers. And we'll get onto the why in a bit, because that's probably the most significant one in a way in terms of salmon catches. But, you know, what's happening now is a crime, actually. 10 years ago or so, I used to fish the Dee every year, and I went round and had a look at the habitat improvement schemes, and it's all very laudable, and all fantastic and necessary. And, you know, I'm very supportive of all of that. But I did write a letter saying to them, it's all very well doing all this habitat improvement, but if you're improving the habitat and there's nobody coming home, it's ultimately pointless. And if we're not careful, you and we, because we're all ultimately responsible, will preside over the demise of the Atlantic salmon. And it is now, it's now a reality, isn't it? And it's not far off in certain rivers. They're talking about the South Coast rivers, the test, the itching. They're an entirely independent genetic strain, aren't they, Jim? You know about this.
Yeah.
Well, go on, you explain what's happening.
Just very quickly, the sort of chalk stream salmon, as you say, you know, arguably one of the oldest strains in the, you know, the recent ice age stock just shy of the south coast of the UK, and the scientists recently have sort of, it's conjecture, but it's, I think it sounds plausible that they're one of the oldest strains of salmon and very different to their Scottish, European, whatever, cousins. And yes, they are absolutely in dire straits. I mean, the numbers from the itching and the test last year are just, it's, you know, it's enough. It's like the why, John. It's enough to make you cry. It really is. It's unsustainable numbers now. I mean, it's too late to be going, oh, let's stick a plaster on it and stick a hatchery in and get the brood stock and all the rest of it. It's just literally all we're doing now is hoping and praying.
Do you think it's gone beyond that then, Jim? Because my feeling is, I mean, I remember not that long ago, my mates, my oldest fishing mate, who I've mentioned a couple of times, he was a member of the Lower Itchen fishery. And he said, okay, you know, not too long ago, they were getting a lot of salmon up there.
There are tiny silver linings, if you can call it that. I mean, they had a 40-pounder, you know, a big, mature, multi-sea winter fish came in last year. But it seems to be the exception that proves the rule. You get the odd incredible specimen, but the rest look like they've done 10 rounds with Tyson. They've just panted their way in, having fought off the nets and all the challenges that salmon face, and especially down there.
I am, and John is the same, we are very pro-stocking. I see no problem at all. People say, oh, you know, genetic integrity. So, yeah, use the brood stock, obviously. Some people say, fry that are planted out don't have the wherewithal to survive in the wild, but I just think it's nonsense. We've created this problem largely. I think we have to intervene to solve it. But I got the impression you were saying that you're not even able to do that on these rivers.
Like all these arguments, you know, it's very river specific. In with the chalk stream, it's probably genetically specific to them. But we've had a lot of guests, and we're due to have a lot of guests on this podcast that were talking about this very thing, and people who are far more versed and whose job it is, scientists, to talk about these things and implement these things. And the pendulum swings wildly depending on who you talk to. I mean, the old way of stocking fish, you know, and putting in hatcheries is probably pretty clumsy and brutal and can be very detrimental to the wild stock, whereas the more modern ways of doing it, and there are many, many ways, the spectrum is wide, it's potentially a last-ditch effort. But it seems to Dara and I think it falls on two very basic arguments. And one is, you can start putting in hatcheries in anywhere now in all these depleted salmon rivers, and you might get, you know, the stocks coming back for 5, 10, maybe 20 years. But I don't think it's going to solve the problem in the long run. Or you're brutal and you go, I mean, subject to all mitigating all the other issues like aquaculture and everything else, that if we could take that out of the way and said, there you go, salmon, the river's yours, go for your life. There's an argument to say if we just left them, and it might take 50, might take 100, might take 500 years, they will come back off their own accord. But it's not going to happen in our lifetime.
Paul, I would have been very much of your thinking. We've spoken to quite a few scientists about this, and the more I talk to the scientists, there was one good phrase one of them said to me, which has always stayed with me, which is, if you want to save the wild fish, avoid the hatchery route. If you want to focus on angling, fair enough, put in a hatchery, but you're going to pretty much kill off
the wild fish that exist in that river. Now, my take on it then was, well, could you concentrate on a couple of rivers and say, just pretty much say, look, they're dead or they're going to die. Let's just give them up to wild fishing, and can we put hatcheries in there and build it up that way?
I've had this rubbish for years and years and years, and I want to take it back throughout the 1990s and right up to 2010. We had had so much scientific research on the Wensum. There were endless bodies, endless scientists looking at the problem of the roach on the Wensum. And of course, it was all, as we hear still today, habitat, 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 or habitat comes out of your ears. We've got to do this, we've got to do that, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. And if we do that, the roach will be back. Now, Paul and I aren't idiots. It might look like we're idiots, but we're not idiots. And we know that habitat is incredibly important. Of course, habitat's important. But if there are no blooming fish, I nearly went overboard there. If there are no blooming fish in the first place, it doesn't matter how magnificent the habitat is, you can't get any fish to inhabit it. And the problem with the Wensum was there were loads of things that were just not dealt with at all because there were inconvenient truths. And the inconvenient truth was that whilst the habitat on the Wensum was pretty good by about 2010, there was still no roach. A large reason for that was that the roach population had shrunk to such a degree it couldn't sustain itself and it needed boosting, it needed restocking. The second thing was that the amount of predation, particularly from cormorants, was off the scale, and nobody would address that at all. That was just an inconvenient truth, which we're very good at sweeping under the carpet in this day and age. Now, one of the reasons that the Environment Agency stood out against restocking the Wensum with roach was exactly this genetic thing. Oh, we can't stock the river Wensum with roach because the Wensum roach are DNA specific, the neat, blah, 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 blah. When I was a kid in the 1960s, the roach in the Wensum was stocked from all over the blooming place. They came from the Broads, they came from the Thames, they came from the Fens, they came from everywhere. So those amazing roaches we were catching in the late 60s, the 70s and the 80s, there was nothing pure about them. They just hit the Wensum, which was a massively rich environment, and they grew massive, and they grew in, and they were just massively, massively prolific. So around about 1970, 1980, all these fishery scientists, science courses began at universities everywhere. And now we have a plethora of fishery science scientists who all have their axes to grind. Obviously, they don't want any silver bullets because that puts them out of jobs, it hampers their researches and so on and so on. I then translate my Wensum roach experiences to salmon rivers. And because I've gone fishing, I've been like bullnose to one salmon river after another, and they've all collapsed by and large. A salmon now. Here, salmon jump is, wow, you know, write home, tell your mother, ring Paul, etc. And we can wamble on like this for years and years and years saying, oh, stocking is dreadful, DNA, blah, blah, blah. You know, surely for 25 years, we've concentrated on habitat and it has got us nowhere, absolutely nowhere.
We've concentrated on it. And the salmon is just still declining.
There is so much focus on the freshwater, right? It's almost like, well, we don't really know what's going on out in the ocean, so we'll just concentrate on what we can kind of work on. And I like, for me, it's the elephant in the room in terms of what's going on out there. So part of the problem, though, surely, John, is in terms of with the salmon, because of the survival rate of the ocean, what's going on out there, no matter how what goes into the rivers, it's still going to struggle.
Of course, I will accept. The lifestyle of a roach and the salmon is completely different. I mean, you know, I've got that. And I do accept, obviously, there are lots of issues in the ocean. But the fact is, if there are only 100 smolts leaving the river Wye for the ocean, then those 100 smolts have virtually no chance whatsoever. If there are 100,000, then let's see. You know, I just think the numbers now have got so small that the few that do get out to the sea are just going to be swallowed up and lost. It's a simple matter of numbers, I think. Paul and I see this everywhere we go. On one side, you have the scientists who have loads of their axes to grind because they're all really looking for project money, project money, project money. On the other side of the fence, you have all the gillies and the people who are involved in salmon fishing, and they've got their axe to grind because obviously they don't want to lose their jobs. But there is this colossal divide between people who live on the river, people whose living depends on salmon being in the river, and the scientists who have their own living to think about, which is really theoretical.
You could almost argue, John, that the scientists depend on there not being many salmon in the river.
How many times have I heard scientists say, oh, there's no silver bullet solution to this? Well, there is probably no silver bullet solution to this, but at least we've got to try far more things than the scientists are coming up with. And we have tried habitat till it's coming out of our ears. And it's just not enough. I was on the River Wye in the 90s when the YS Foundation started. And I was entranced by the Stephen Marsh Smiths and all his vision for the Wye and opening up the spawning streams again and putting chalk in and doing this and draining. You know, it was fantastic putting fish passes in. Yeah. And back in the 90s, a load of work was done. Hats off to the YS Foundation. They did do a tremendous amount. But of course, the more they did, the fewer salmon there were. I mean, the salmon were just going down the tubes, and year after year, they spent millions and millions of pounds trying on the habitat, and it's had no effect whatsoever.
Maybe, though, can we have the best of both worlds in the sense of, you know, can we say certain rivers, right, we're going to focus on stocking here and use the best of science.
Like they do in Iceland.
And unfortunately, and I hate saying this, but give up on those rivers to a certain extent and say, okay, look, we've given up on them from a wild fish point of view, so now let's see where we can get with the hatcheries. But at the same time, let's not completely give up on the wild fishing and say, look, these other rivers over here, that's where we're going to try and...
I think that is a brilliant idea. Let's say, for sake of argument, we will carry on with the habitat route on this river, this river, this river, this river. Let's, on some of these rivers where perhaps the DNA of the salmon isn't quite as precious or acknowledged, let us try the hatchery route on these rivers. And at least let us say to fishery scientists, at least open your mind wide enough to allow a few experiments on a few rivers and see how we get on.
I'll jump
Go
in
on,
here.
Paul.
I made a comparison the other day to Gyrodactylus in Norway. And when that hit, we all were terrified, weren't we? And we all had to disinfect our gear wherever we'd been, wherever we were, yeah, whenever we were coming back to a home river. And the Norwegians, they didn't muck about. They closed, I think, two rivers, they closed and repopulated those, wiped it out and populated those rivers. As anglers, most of us would go, do you know what? If some drastic action like that would solve the problem of the wild salmon, most anglers, I think, would say, absolutely, get on with it. You could suspend salmon angling on the Wye these days, and it probably, given the parlous state of the Wye stock, and it probably wouldn't affect the local community as much as, say, a river in Scotland. The Wye is a mixed fishery. If people come to the Wye to fish for barbel and for coarse fish and chub and pike and perch. You close a river in Scotland to do the same thing, or you allow a river in Scotland to fall off a cliff like the Wye, and you are taking away the livelihoods of a lot of people. I know it seems simplistic, but we've let these people have their heads for over 20 years, is what I said. John, I've seen the work they've done on the D, opening up, having taken out structures, but it's just nonsense because the salmon is going, despite all this.
Just sorry, Paul, just to back you up there, the D now, after all this, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn to anyone who's listening, are now, I think, as of this season, some sort of stocking is going to be taking place.
I think you mentioned that to me, Jim, actually. I take your point, Dara, with the C. But we've created the problems in the sea, probably. I mean, I don't know anyone else, any other creatures are doing it. It's humans. It's up to us to solve the problem. I would say tomorrow, I'd say stock everywhere. I'd say crude stock from every salmon river, and I'll stock them. I just think it's crazy, crazy not to do it.
But I think as well, though, Paul, part of the problem is I'm starting to now think maybe, well, the more we get involved, the more technology starts interfering with nature, that's when we're creating the problem. So by us trying to think technology will solve the problem, is that not just going to make it worse? And that's where I'm at.
My last serious salmon fishing used to take place probably 10 years ago on the Miramichi in Canada. And I went out, first of all, with a party of journalists in about 2011. And the river was full of salmon. It was just like the Tweed, as I remember, back in 1980. It was just unbelievably full of salmon. And then as journalists, we were all taken to the hatcheries. And the hatcheries on the Miramichi were off the scale. It was just a huge industrial unit about the size of Swindon with millions and millions of juvenile salmon. And these went into the Miramichi. And it was astounding, that river. It was absolutely heaving the salmon. And, you know, as far as they were concerned, we'll give you 3 days on the river catching more salmon than you've ever seen in all your life. And the last day, we'll show you where it all began in this enormous, enormous hatchery. There were billions of fish.
There's something wrong with that, though, at the same time, John, isn't there?
But there's something wrong with the world, Dara. We've created such a dreadful world for the salmon, and we can't. You can do specific policies, but we live in an industrialized part of the world. We're not somewhere where we can't intervene.
It's interesting what you're saying about the Miramichi there, John, and, you know, to a lesser extent, but similar business model. You look at the Tyne, which had a successful hatchery program there, but in recent years, is it failing? It's certainly up for debate, isn't it? I don't know. I can't speak for the Miramichi, but I doubt its catch numbers are what they were. And I think, and I've read an article, I don't know whether you've read this recently, and it's really, for me, it really brought it home, is like all these things, we're probably looking under the wrong stone. And actually, the problem is, it's much more basic. We can do what we want with the salmon. We can put hatcheries in every river. We can up the smolts tenfold, a millionfold. But there just isn't the food for them that there was. The invertebrate life is not there in the river. This is to do with pollution, climate change, all the things that we know about. And the food isn't there for them out at sea because the seas are warmer, and the cyclical nature of the food, or their food, is going in different directions, is going north. So we can pump salmon into the world left, right and center, but they ain't got nothing to eat. So they're just going to die.
So what will habitat improvement in rivers do to...
Well, I know, exactly. But fundamentally, we all know that insects have pretty much halved since the 80s, insect life, certainly, you know, rurally and in the UK, should I say. And we know that the par and the juvenile salmon, they feed off these things. And then when they're out of the sea, they're after the sand eels and the shrimps and all the things that are also dwindling. So... That to me is the problem. It's just a simple food. It's a simple food chain thing.
But Jim, as Paul is saying, I mean, if we are saying that the root cause of this, and I'm not saying that you're not right at all, but if we're saying that there is now, because of all these issues, there is now no more food really in the sea, and because of so many issues that we're discussing, there's very, very little food in the upper rivers. Basically, we're saying we're stuffed. Really, there is nothing even our marvellous, wonderful fishery scientists can do.
It's certainly worth looking at, and therefore changing the paradigm of how we argue for the sake of what we do for the salmon. And if we are going to go on the fact that we think that the food source is absolutely depleted, then it might encourage, let's put more in the rivers anyway, because what we got to lose? It's not as, you know, white flag and surrendering as perhaps it sounds, but it's certainly it certainly, you've got to think about that, haven't you? It's not, as you say, I'm backing you up, it's not about just about restoring. I'm not going to use that word rewilding, even though I did, but we're swearing on this show, so it's fine. you know, river restoration and all that stuff, it may or may not work, but I think we've got to chuck as much at the problem as we can.
I think so as well, Jim. I think, you know, what have we got to lose? What on earth have we got to lose?
I agree. I mean, I don't think Paul and I are saying that we take our eye off the ball when it comes to habitat. You know, there's no thought there. But as Paul has just said, we have at this moment in time, when it comes to salmon fishing, we have absolutely nothing to lose. The problem in this country is that we talk and we talk and we talk. It doesn't matter what you look at, whether it's the post office scandal or the scandal of losing salmon. Talk and we do nothing, you know? And it's just about time that in this country we stopped sweeping inconvenient truths under carpets and actually started doing something.
I like your option, Dara, of maybe isolating some rivers and saying, right, we'll get on the habitat improvement, set aside, if you like. Yes, yeah, set aside, you know, the old agricultural term, and allow, see what nature can do. And then other rivers, we go, right, we're going to stop. As I say, as an angler myself, and it's easy for me to say this, I will give up salmon fishing. You know, if I know that there's a program in place to restore the salmon, I'm very happy to practice catamaran. I'm very happy to stop. On certain rivers, you can't fish. You can't fish the salmon. That's that. But you need to show people that you are trying to restore the salmon on those rivers, because we will be taking away people's livelihoods. Livelihoods that are going to disappear anyway if we're not careful. Unless you're lucky enough to be on a mixed fishery like the Wye. So, you know, it's horses for courses, and I love the idea of trying that approach. But my thing is throw as many salmon at the problem as possible now. And let's see. What else is there to do? What else is there to do?
I am 100% behind Paul here. Let's say that Paul's a fantastic solution would be taken up. And let's say that for 10 years, we closed the salmon fishing on the Wye and we reinstituted a hatchery on the Wye. And we kept the fishing open, obviously, on the Dee and the Tay and the Spey and so on. But how are we going to do it? Who's going to do it? When are we going to do it? And sadly, these sort of arguments are not really quite getting us anywhere until we actually convince science, who have the ear of the government, to actually say, yes, we will try this. I mean, while scientists are still saying no, 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 then basically we'll have these very well-informed conversations. Paul will be 300% right. Who's going to do it? When are we going to do it? We close the Wye. Paul and I have a vested interest in the Wye. We really look at the Wye. We make it a test case. We put a hatchery on it. We reserve salmon fishing for a while. How do we go about this? What do we do? What are the steps?
Exactly. And I think we're a bit leaderless in that respect, and we need a much stronger structure. And what gives me hope, as I hope it does you guys, is the fact, as bleak as it is, the Atlantic salmon is now on the red list, as we know, as of December 23. It's an endangered species officially, which should bring a lot more awareness to a wider public and hopefully change policy on that, which brings me on very quickly to my next issue, or my next question for you both, really, regarding activism. And we talk a lot about activism on this show, just because up until recently it was obviously a very dirty, stigmatized word, and it sort of had references to violent protests and tree hugging nuisances and what have you. But it really seems that citizen scientists are getting somewhere. You know, the louder we shout and the more of us there are, it reluctantly it's making governments hopefully do something about it, maybe not the current government. Paul, you first. Your fantastic documentary, I think it was last year, with regards to the water companies. When I spoke to you about this a few years ago, you seemed quite reluctant to to be a mouthpiece for these things, because it quite rightly you felt, you know, it wasn't perhaps your job. You weren't as informed or as educated as other people who were better qualified to talk about it. But you suddenly had a change of tack and you came out the activist closet. What made you come out?
Well, to be honest, Jim, you're right. No, there are people who are a lot more well versed in the ins and outs of our.
There aren't, Paul. Get on with it. No.
Yeah, get the humility bullshit out of the way.
Made me actually step out of the closet was gone fishing to an extent, Jim. You know, there's been Bob, you know, sort of poncing around, painting this glorious picture of our beautiful rivers. And of course, you and I know, we got Fogel on when we fished the Upper Lea.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
And I used to fish the Lea as a kid, you know, on London Anglers club ticket. And we used to catch a lot of chub. I mean, heavily fished venue, you know. And they kind of ruined it in the end because they opened both banks and ruined it. But the Upper Lea still maintains some of that. It's a chalk stream, you know, up there. Fogel came on and he said, look, that sick there, that bit there, you know, that this is the chalk stream. You can see the glory of a chalk stream because are there any more beautiful bits of water than a chalk stream? I'm not sure. Maybe the Y and the Spray and the D. But you can see it there, you know, you could see it. You could see this pristine little stream that had started to, it was a bit sick. And Fogel, as we all know, initially Fogel was banging the drum about abstraction because a lot of those Hertfordshire chalk streams, like the Mimrail, were drying up. And that was abstraction. And I think as he began to dig below the surface, then I've been aware of pollution all my life, you know, since fishing with my dad in the early days. Where I was born in the Rhondda Valley, we moved to London when I was four. But the River Rhondda used to run black with coal dust because the colliery just went straight into the river. Now, those rivers sort of cleaned up as the industrial, you know, heartlands died away. And now we get this more insidious pollution. Obviously, as you know, Dara, with the eutrophication of the great Irish lochs, you know, from agricultural pollution. And then this water company thing, though, the idea that they can pump raw sewage directly into our rivers. I didn't know that that was the case. I didn't know that they were allowed to do it. Never mind that. Not only are they allowed to do it, they're also doing it illegally. And, you know, Fogel was banging the drum. You were shouting from the rooftops, Jim. And because I've gone fishing, I felt I'm sort of compelled to do something because I can't keep presenting. And, you know, so I, you know, obviously give Fogel his platform as well. Not that he needs it, but, you know, I was sort of every man in it, really, Jim, you know.
But that worked.
Yeah, you know.
Worked brilliantly.
And, you know, it's like John says, we talk a lot in this country. Whether anything gets done, I don't know. But it's certainly, as you were just saying about the salmon, water quality and pollution is now on the agenda for most political parties. And maybe the salmon, how can it not be in places like Scotland, Ireland, and Wales to an extent? You know, it's perhaps not as significant in England, but again, the chalk stream, as you were saying, the chalk stream, let's hope it gets on the agenda a bit more. And I think, Dari, your that route you were talking about is actually, and I'm being slightly opportunistic here, is actually a way we can stock some salmon rivers. So you go, right, these are the wild ones. You get on with that, and we'll go over here and we'll throw a load of salmon at these rivers. And I think it's a very valuable way to go forward because, you know, you're saying to the fishery scientist, okay, you can have your head there, but give us the chance to try this solution over here.
Two of the things that are really standing in the way between the Wye and being a healthy, productive, fertile river again, to me, they're both quite manageable. First of all, we've got to do something about the chicken farms and what's done with the feces. And secondly, somehow a concordat has to be reached with canoeists to say you can't canoe in these areas at these times in the water conditions. But how are we going to do that? Because the canoeists are absolutely vitriolic when it comes to their rights. So, I mean, I'll get out there with a placard if it does any good, but I'll probably just have my aged graying head kicked in. You know, so how we actually do something, and I think the Y is a perfect example to say, yes, let's try hatcheries on the Y. But until we do something about the chicken farms and until we do something about the flotillas of canoes that just kick the gravels to kingdom come, we're going to be here.
And it strikes me it'd be so easy put some sort of blockage where the reds are and let the canoeists have their little stretch of river and everybody could enjoy it equally. And it's not going to take much.
Can I ask you then, this might be a good time, we ask all our guests these last few questions. And it is, if you had £1 billion, so if you took 10% of your portfolio, Paul.
Paul, maybe £2 billion for you.
Sorry, you're very funny. Can I just say, as if I've got a bloody portfolio, I'm the biggest moron in the world, believe me. What do you say? It's easy to earn it. It's keeping hold of it. That's the...
Yeah, yeah, true.
Especially when you're into salmon fishing.
Yeah. Anyway, if I had £1 billion, I wouldn't give a toss about the salmon. I'd go back to Brazil.
Okay, if you had a conscience, what would you do with the billion?
Yeah, a conscience and a billion. What would you do?
I was given £1 billion that I had to spend on Atlantic salmon.
Yes.
But I might buy a river and keep it to myself. I could do that, couldn't I?
And stuff it full of fish.
Canoes in there. I'd set up a chicken farm.
Fish farm at the bottom. It'd be amazing.
I'd burn effigies of Bailey every day. No, you know what I'd do, Dara? I would start a radical stocking program. And not just of salmon either, of other species as well. But especially salmon in the most endangered rivers.
John?
Oh, well, I'd just employ more fishery scientists. That's where my... No, I would do exactly like Paul. I would try and buy the entire River Wye, and I would try and impose concordats with canoeists, and I would do something about the chicken farms. And then we'd see if hatcheries actually could stand a chance. It's very... I will look into my portfolio and see how much money I've got to spend.
Yeah, we only need the interest. That's all we need.
But I think it's quite straightforward. And I love the concept that we could make the Y a test case. I think that's a really sound idea. And, you know, it wouldn't be putting lots and lots of people out of work if we suspended salmon fishing for a little while we saw what we could do with it. I think the Y would be a good place to start this.
Jokes aside, I think let's get the Y, which is a real flagship river and a river that's constantly in the news and is really on the ropes right now and is a gem of the British river system. Let's do that. Let's campaign to do that. Let's make it a test case and do these things to it, because wouldn't it be fantastic if we got some success?
As you say, it's so significant given it's salmon history. Look at, like, you know.
Wasn't it C.S. Lewis that called it the Golden Valley? I'm in love with it. It's just the most beautiful place on earth. It's heaven on earth for me. Next question. If you haven't got loads of money, as in your dirt skin, like we are, let's be honest, because we spend it all on fucking fishing, what can we do? What can you tell the audience? What wisdom can you share? What can they go and do today that might make a difference?
Well, I think as you suggested earlier, Jim, you can make your protests public. You know, you can draw attention to the plight of our rivers. I went to visit on during that documentary, the river, I think it's the Tame, which is kind of in Greater Manchester, and it was polluted to hell. And a couple of, you know, local boys in there, you know, they proper, man, you know. They're Stockport County fans. You know, they remember John Bailey in his prime. That's not the Tay District Board or the bloody D Board. These are working class blokes, and they've restored it. And, you know, they did get the Environment Agency down to help them bring it back. They've got a club there now that you don't even have to pay to join. So they've kept it open, you know, to the public for no. And while we were there, though, United Utilities were publicly treated effluent into the while we were filming, you know. So, you know, you're fighting a battle all the time, but they'd certainly turned their river around, you know, and they were dedicated guys who thought, well, no, we're not taking it any longer. We are going to restore this river. And, you know, hats off to them. They've done a bloody good job against, you know, all the odds, really.
So get off your ass and you realize.
I mean, I'm not going to do it.
No, you're not going to do it, love. You're on the telly.
Yeah, but I'll be on the telly saying, well done, guys.
Well done. It was because of me, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Great, though, Paul. No, that's good. That's what we're getting from most people is we can all do something. You know, all we have to do is take that first step and it gets results remarkably quickly.
I think that we have talked a lot of doom and gloom when it comes to salmon, and probably there is no easy fix with salmon. I think we've probably got to accept that for all the reasons that we've mentioned. I think that when I was a tiny kid, when I was 5 and 6, when I was brought up in the Northwest, the River Goyt ran at the bottom of our garden, and it used to flow purple, orange, pink, whatever the dye the mills were using. There wasn't a stickleback in the place, and now there are grayling and barbel there. So I think the Wild Trout Trust, although, you know, there are people who have question marks about that, but it would seem to me the Wild Trout Trust actually is one of these organizations that really does a lot and achieves a lot and relies on mostly voluntary labor. And I think if we really, really care about it, we can make a real impact on smaller rivers. Probably not the salmon, because we are looking at a cosmic problem, as we've all agreed. But I think on small rivers, with a lot of hard work, Paul and I are trustees of a charity called Fish in Need. And that's exactly what that's set up to do. It's set up to look at small, isolated cases where a bit of money and a bit of hard work can actually make the environment, the habitat, better for fish. And it like is succeeding in small pockets.
That's a good point, because Finn is, we do the two things, bit of habitat improvement and a restocking program. And we're a small organization, John, but we try and target things very specifically.
If you tackle one problem at a time, it stacks up pretty quickly. Paul, QC Rowley Birkin, that much-loved national treasure of a character that you so beautifully created and brought to our screens and made us all laugh over many years. He was a fisherman, right? He was based on a fisherman, should I say.
I've got a little an epilogue, actually, to the Rowley Birkin story. I met this guy when I was fishing in Iceland on the Ranga, the stocked Icelandic salmon river. And I met this guy and he was talking. I couldn't understand a word he said. We sit there, this actor chappy, and he was talking to me. And I was like, yeah, that was me. He said, this actor chappy came in and caught all the bloody fish. And I looked like, And I thought, wow, this guy's good gold for the far side. I think the best line of his I ever did was this, Cairo. You know, it just kind of creates this romantic, sort of desperate world, that place that he's caught in, you know. And we gave him a much more romantic life than any of us had ever had. It's like John's. And that was based on this guy, Andrew Rollo. But anyway, I got a message from Marina Gibson yesterday saying, look at this text exchange. And a friend of hers was Andrew Rollo's granddaughter. She got this text exchange with this friend of hers saying, Paul Whitehouse based the character on my granddad, Andrew Rollo. So there you go. Yeah, it's true.
That's incredible. And we do meet these fantastic, almost caricatures, don't you, on the riverbank that you always remember.
Final day on Earth. Paul, we'll start with you. Where would you fish it?
Has anyone fished the Naver?
Yeah.
What a river. And I remember getting some spring salmon on a floating line. I mean, the conditions weren't exactly beautiful, but to catch those spring salmon on floating line, fantastic. That was an amazing river. I was never asked back. Perfume, I saw him the other day. He said he's only been once or twice and not been asked back. You probably are, Jim.
No, I've been for a day because I was on the Thurso and they said, you've got an opportunity because a rod didn't turn up. And you're right. I went, you know, can I come back? And they were like, no,
That's it. Right, that's yours. So a bit of me would like to do that. Some of the rivers and lake, I mean, Thingvallavatn Lake in Iceland.
Oh, yeah.
Lakes. Mm. I caught trout there once. It was 14 pounds, right, which is not a big trout for Thingvallavatn, but it was silver. What the fish, the guide went, what the fish? And he claimed that it was like years old and never spawned. That lake is extraordinary, and so that is incredible. I'm not going to pinpoint one place. I'm doing the lot. So Iceland, I'd like the morning in Iceland. I'd like a couple of hours on the neighbour at lunchtime. All right, then I'd like Hawaii in the afternoon. Actually, early morning, a bit of tench fishing with John. Bob can come, and then perhaps a couple of hours on the test. In the evening, Jim, and a quick retreat to the Greyhound. How about that for a nice day's fishing, eh?
That's a nice day. And then you peacefully pass away with your rod in your hand.
Yeah, everyone. And away.
Lovely. Thanks, Paul. And what about yourself, John?
If I could go back to a river in time, if I could go back to a river how it once was, then it would obviously be the Wensum. On a mild December morning in 1971, 72, somewhere around Swanton Morley, which is 10 miles upstream of Norwich. And I'd probably go back with John Wilson because he did teach me how to trot a river. We'd be looking down the river as the sun is rising in the east, and there'd be two and three quarter pound roach rolling like great golden saucers and wallop, wallop, wallop. Now, presuming that's not going to happen again, as things now are, I would probably go to the River Shiskit, be careful how you say that, in northern Mongolia, because I think from gather that is still absolutely as pristine as it was when God made it. And the grayling fishing, the trout fishing, and the taimen fishing, which, as we know, is a landlocked salmon, is still magnificent as it probably was a million years ago. And so is the landscape. And it's all down to the fact there are no people. And wherever you have people, you have problems. And where there is nobody, nature reigns supreme.
People equal problems.
I mean, that was beautiful and very poetic, John. I was about to say, maybe you need to persuade the commissioners at the BBC to take the show to places like that. But you don't really, do you? Because the whole point is you want to keep those places away from people. And let's show the people on the show where they can go and what's accessible for them, I guess, as a gateway into fishing. But that was great. Thank you. Thank you both.
Do you know what this was like being in a fishing lodge?
Mm.
At the end of a day, fishing, we mightn't have caught any salmon. Maybe there was no salmon to be seen. But it, you know what? We still had a bit of crack. Oh, we had a bit of fun.
It's true, isn't it?
Depending on how it goes down, that we might come back in a year and say, you know, let's talk about what we spoke about back then. And hopefully we'll be saying, hey, you know that idea that we had about making, you know, certain rivers fish angling rivers and certain rivers, you know, restorative rivers? Could happen. Could be around the corner. Who knows?
Excellent. All the best, guys.
Coming up on the next episode of The Last Salmon,
we talk to the most driven, the most effective, arguably the most successful salmon advocate there is alive today.
There's no pension that comes with this. There's no raise. There's no promotion. But when you look out your window and you see the fish that you fought for so long returning, that is the ultimate award.
The hugely acclaimed author of Not On My Watch, Alexandra Morton.
It's more than happiness. It's realizing that we've become a force of nature because this is the natural system that I was able to play a role in helping.
Listen and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd really appreciate any reviews and feedback that you can send us. And also keep up to date on Instagram @TheLastSalmon.
And remember to keep in the fight for our salmon.